This week, we welcome David Chamberlain, Managing Director of CRA's Strategic Communication Practice, to discuss security incidents, simple responses that make all the difference. In the Leadership and Communication section, financial targets don't motivate employees, Texas power outage flags need to revisit business continuity, security job candidate background checks, what you can and can't do, and more. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Week.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 207, recorded March 1st, 2021. I am your host, Matt Alderman, here in Colorado. Joining me from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island is my first co-host, Mr. Paul Asadorian.
Hey, Matt. Good to be here.
Happy Monday.
Happy Monday.
And joining us remotely on the lines today is my second co-host, Mr. Jason Albuquerque.
Hello there. Great to be here.
I thought after last week's show, you were just going to always go into studio because it was so
I really wanted to, and then the kiddos came down with a little something, and I didn't want to spread the wealth. So I figured I'd stay away from the studio and not bring any disease in.
I'm sure there's a few in studio that appreciate that, Paul included. Do you want to stay in the loop on all things Security Weekly? Visit securityweekly.com/subscribe to subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher or our YouTube channel. Sign up for our mailing list and join our Discord server. Also, do you have a specific guest or topic that you want us to cover on one of the shows? Submit your suggestions for guests by visiting securityweekly.com/guests and completing the form. If you're interested in topics, I just updated the new content plan for Security Weekly, which tells you all the topics Paul wants to see. We will review those suggestions monthly and we'll reach out to you once reviewed. Our guest for this segment is David Chamberlain. He is the Managing Director of CRA's Strategic Communication Practice with 20 years of global experience building and transforming teams for some of the world's leading brands. David partners with leaders to strategically drive business results, build trust and credibility, strengthen relationships with stakeholders, and successfully navigate and mitigate the critical issues affecting their organization. He also helped found and lead Edelman's Global Data Security and Privacy Group, which helps organizations prepare for, respond to, and recover from cybersecurity incidents with hundreds of millions of victims. David, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's great to be here.
The first thing we have to get out of the way is CRA. That is not Cyber Risk Alliance, which is the company we work for. First start, who is CRA? Because I don't want to confuse our audience.
So CRA is Communications Research Associates, and it's a management consulting firm that works with a number of Fortune 500 or 100 companies. So we help organizations manage their most strategic relationships. So whether that's boards or C-suites or communications executives, we help them solve their problems, basically using about 100 years of research on how to best communicate in situations.
And we're going to focus today on security incidents. And look, right. We have this assumption that it's never going to happen to us. I want to talk about some of the challenges with security incidents and some of the lack of preparation by some organizations to be prepared for security incidents. And then we're going to provide some guidance later on. Like, here are the things you should really prepare for just in case to be ready for it. But let's start with some of the challenges, some of the struggles around preparing for security incidents.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been doing this for a number of years. And if you look at the issues that people are having, and I built an audit tool about 7 years ago that we've used with organizations, and it really comes down to areas around comms planning, testing and readiness, and communications integration within an organization. And so in all of those areas, you see major issues, whether that's not having a crisis plan with cyber, having pre-drafted statements? Is there an IT escalation path? You know, all of those types of things. Have you even done a simulation? Because we know that going through a simulation actually helps you respond better and deal with the situation at hand. Testing those protocols, you know, involving your audience tends to be, I think, IT and business folks, but, you know, how engaged are operations, legal, sales, marketing, if one of these types of things were to happen? Most of them aren't. And so it's completely, it's like speaking a different language for a lot of people within an organization when they get hit.
And these communication plans are just not limited to security incidents. I mean, we're going to talk about the Texas power outage, right? That had major business continuity ramifications for people in the state and out of the state. I mean, these communication plans are just there. It's not just security incidents. It could be any type of incident.
Yeah, what I've done throughout my career is really helped corporations and organizations build crisis communications plans. So whether that's a workplace violence situation, whether that's a facility down, or I'm in Dallas, Texas, so I know what it's like to go without power for a few days, a couple weeks ago. All of those types of, you know, what we consider most likely and most detrimental to the organization, it's called the top right box. And so what we're really focused on there is, what are those 3 to 5 situations that are most likely going to cause problems for your organization that you're going to have to respond to and that could do significant damage to your organization? And so you're right, it's not just cyber, it's things like power outages and electricity outages and no heat and other things, no food delivery and gas in Texas. That shuts businesses down. And in most cases, I find that they aren't typically prepared.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, one of the things that I have felt throughout my career that helped me kind of build my chops with incident response and from a cyber perspective is I was in the public sector. So I was heavily involved with emergency management type activities, right? So in that phase of my career, I had to interface with the Rhode Island EMA and really learn their incident command system. And that gave me a wealth of knowledge on how to respond to incidents, again, outside of technology, right? Which could be events that are, you know, driven out of natural disaster, events from the grid, you know, any type of you know, attack that may happen from the human perspective, right? So, you know, shooter type engagements and that type of thing. But that gave me such a wealth of knowledge on how to build the structure and framework around incident response that, you know, throughout my career, I didn't reinvent the wheel. I took that knowledge and it helped build my incident response program.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, what you find is, and I want to be careful when I say this, it's not all companies. Regulated industries, I used to be the chief communications officer at PNC, the fifth largest bank in the U.S., they're going through regular simulations once or twice a year. They're breaking things down. They've got their plans. They're exercising them. You know, that's a big deal. But in those non-regulated areas, to your point, you know, it makes a big difference. And I think what people don't know, just in the cyberspace alone, and IBM and the Poneman Institute just put these numbers out, but if you've got that incident response preparedness plan and you have your team determined, that savings alone is roughly $2 million in an incident. And it's the largest cost saver for businesses going in incident response. And while that doesn't necessarily play out to other crisis incidents, because I couldn't tell you what those dollar amounts would be in terms of savings, that's a lot of money that people are leaving on the table.
Yeah, definitely. Do we have an issue with, I don't need to do this because I have cyber insurance? How does cyber insurance play into this? How do I handle a security incident? Does it only cloudy kind of the challenges around this a bit? Because people are like, I've got cyber insurance and, you know, it's going to be handled by my policy.
Yeah, cyber insurance is an interesting beast because I do think that the people that have it kind of look at things that way, Matt. But I also know from my own experience working with organizations that have been hit that cybersecurity policies don't cover everything. And there's a lot of questions as to what they will and won't cover and up to how much. And whose fault was it? Was it yours because there was human error or other things? So there are a lot of in and outs regarding cyber policies. And I'm not an insurance expert, but just having been in hundreds of these types of incidents, you see a lot of things pop up that a lot of people take for granted that they're going to be covered, or, hey, I don't really have to prepare because all of this will, you know, be paid for. What they don't realize is that 85% of people that go through a cybersecurity incident as a customer talk about their negative experience. And 33, 34% use social media to complain about their experience. So cyber insurance doesn't do anything about that. You know, 83% of consumers in the US, according to some research, say that they'll stop spending in a business for several months immediately after a breach. That's not covered by cyber insurance. There's nothing about brand recovery in cyber insurance. So there are a number of things, or even in the prep, that if I were a cyber insurer, I'd be, and I were insuring someone, I'd be making sure that there were a certain number of things that were actually done by the company before they were eligible for the cyber insurance.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point.
That's a great point. I mean, you know, the relationships I have with those cyber insurance companies, you know, once you contact them, the first thing they do is they assign a fiduciary, which is typically an attorney, right? And and from there, the clock is ticking. And if you're not prepared and you don't have all of your ducks in the row, your people, your process, you know, all of your communication strategies, ultimately you're going to end up paying for it because they're going to bring in a third party to get it done for you. And, you know, the more that you can present to the insurance companies and present to this fiduciary that you do have your ducks in a row, number one, the less out of scope cost you're going to have for that incident, right? Because you're not going to have to pay a professional to actually come in and do it for you. But you're also going to be viewed better in the lens of the insurance agency, right? As you come out of this. So there's benefit there from really two sides of the aisle, the short-term spend for the incident, but then that long-term spend that you may have from an insurance perspective.
David, having said all that, I mean, is there value to having cyber insurance? Like, what's the value?
So I'm working with a number of companies right now, and, you know, my expenses, the law firm's expenses, the forensic firm's expenses are all being covered by that.
So it helps a little with the expenses, in other words.
Yeah. So you're looking at the average cost of a data breach or ransomware attack right now is running around $8.64 million. So there's a lot of costs that they potentially take off your plate. So it's helpful. I'm not saying it's not. It's just it's not the magic bullet.
It doesn't help restore customer confidence or make up for any losses in customer confidence.
Exactly. And that's why preparation on the front end is so important, because there are certain things, you know, that you need to get done. One of the biggest wastes of time, and you didn't ask, but I'll just go here. One of the biggest wastes of time that I deal with in terms of being able to respond to an incident for a company is they haven't chosen their outside cyber law firm. They haven't chosen their forensics team. They haven't chosen their communications team. So imagine trying to do three or four engagement letters and scopes of work and other things and coming to agreement on time and hours, and then cyber insurers will only pay certain dollar amounts per hour. That takes days. Mm-hmm. So at the very beginning of your response, if you don't even have that done, you're already days behind.
Yeah. So that's what I want to talk about. Like, what are the simple steps organizations should do to prepare before they have a security incident? Now, you named a couple of them, but I'm sure there's a few more that we have to think about before we go out and choose our forensics firm, our law firm, and our communications firm.
No, there are. I mean, first and foremost, and this comes down to any crisis plan, right? Who's the internal and the external team that you're going to use? So I mentioned the external, but on the internal, who are those experts going to be? Who from legal is going to be part of that? Who from communications? Who from IT? Where you run into problems is when that isn't identified, or you run into a situation where everybody decides they want to be part of it, and suddenly you end up with 25 people on a call. And I've been on those calls, and they're painful because you start to edit press releases with 25 people. So, you know, that type of thing, having, you know, most people don't think about this, but do they have a baseline for corporate reputation with their key stakeholders? And in a breach I worked with a major online auction site a few years ago, that was really critical because we were able to see not only where our corporate reputation or their corporate reputation was, but we were able to go out and survey them after the incident and see what was most important in terms of the response from the company. So asking those types of things and having that baseline was key. You know, having that communications chain of command where they're for multiple scenarios. So we mentioned earlier kind of cyber and then workplace violence, power outages, those types of things, making sure that you have those. This will sound scary, but meeting your state legislators, regulators, and policymakers beforehand, do you know them? You should know them. The first place the first time you meet them, you don't want that to be when the attorney general is coming after you. I've been on those calls. They're not pleasant. I've been on calls with up to 43 attorney generals meeting people for the first time. Now, I'm not saying go meet all 50 attorney generals, but, you know, who are those policymakers and regulators that you want to have a relationship with beforehand so that they know you, they know you're trustworthy, they know you're, you know, who you are, you know.
And David, before we go any further, I know, that's usually like your legal team. When you think about the internal stakeholders, 25 is too many, but is there like an optimal size and optimal kind of roles that need to be on that team? Legal obviously has to be one, but is it 5-6 people? Which roles do they play? Is there kind of an optimal internal team structure?
So you should always have your chief communications officer, your head of communications. You're always going to want to have HR, especially if it involves employees, because you're going to have to deal with them. You always want your general counsel. The question then becomes, does your CEO need to get engaged or do they just need to be updated? And then it comes down to who are those folks that you also need to have. In most cases where you've got customers in a B2B situation, the head of customer service and the heads of lines of business are going to be critical. If you have a call center, you know, you're not going to pull them in right away, but you will end up pulling them in because they're going to have to help deal with all those calls. So I try to counsel folks to have it, you know, no more than 5 to 7, closer to 5 if at all possible, so that you aren't just, you know, bogging down in what's going on.
Yeah, no, 100% right. Agreed. And to be honest with you, you had mentioned it earlier, having a chain of command for the communication side, but I think it's important to have a chain of command for the overall incident response, right? Mm-hmm. Who's quarterbacking the entire show? And then what's that approval process for things to get approved, whether it be communication, right? So you need your PR or marketing firm, whoever's running your communications team, expenditures, your CFO, right? There needs to be an approval process for all of these different activities that are going to happen throughout the incident response.
Right. And in these types of incidents, what I typically see is the GC. And so the GC is kind of playing that role and interfacing back to the CEO and others. That doesn't mean the CEO isn't on the calls or other things, but the GC is really taking care of all of those types of things and making sure that contracts are being approved, that the forensics are being approved. Those types of things are all happening. So in my experience, that's the key person that's usually responsible for those types of things.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And basically, it's the equivalent to the fiduciary, that attorney on the, you know, on the cyber insurance side, right? It's that counterpart.
Exactly. But the other thing that the general counsel and the CEO, and honestly, if I were on a board, and I've been on boards of organizations, one of the things that I would be really looking at is, have we conducted that mock crisis simulation? I can tell you probably within the first 5 to 10 minutes of working with a firm, usually 5, whether or not they've actually gone through a simulated cybersecurity incident, because there's a familiarity with terms, there's a familiarity with language, there's a familiarity with each other. And so that's huge, because they just are able to respond better. It usually means that, hey, they may have thought already about how have we segmented our customers and created a hierarchy of them as to who will get white glove outreach and who won't, who's going to get the email notice. You know, they've probably already created an escalation path in terms of reactive, frontline, secondary, you know, and then who are those key folks that when it comes to incidents and compromise and your forensics report, when those questions come up from customers, that's where those go. So thinking all of those types of things through ahead of time is huge. And then even thinking through all the materials that you're going to need just from a communications perspective, you know, making sure that you've got that run of play. What's your holding statement? What's your ultimate statement? You know, do you have your voicemail scripts, your Q's and A's? Mm-hmm. You know, have you segmented out your communications so that whoever's talking with their group has a limited amount of information that fits their customers or their partners or their or others? So all of those types of things you're going to end up dealing with. And if you have frontline employees, have you actually thought through, and this is where I spend a lot of time, training hundreds of employees at a time in cyber or in Zoom and Teams calls in the last year, but really walking them through training as to what to say, how to handle questions, you know, all those types of things, letting them role play, you know, 24 mm-hmm. hours before we have to go live so that they understand how to do it. But most companies haven't done those types of simulations or taken those things into account ahead of time.
Yeah. And they, I mean, there's only one way to do it, right? It's to practice. Exactly. Ultimately, I equate it to muscle memory. Right? It's very obvious if you don't have the muscle memory when you get into that incident response scenario.
Yeah, it's just like shooting free throws, right? All of us probably played basketball. I know I did, or baseball, or whatever the sport. You practice and you sit on the line, or you sit in the batter's box and you take your swings or you take your free throws and you practice them. And honestly, I think that companies, if they would just take the time, you know, it's not a huge lift. You can have someone build a simulation pretty easily. That 2 or 4 hours every 6 months or once a year is a tremendous help to organizations as they deal with these things.
Yeah. I've talked about this story briefly on the podcast before. I had a really good friend, CEO of a company, that had an incident. They got a business email compromise and ended up wiring money to some other country that wasn't supposed to happen. And they didn't have a plan in place. So he calls me up because I'm in the industry. And I think, you know, it's tough because you're in the middle of the crisis. It's like, what do I do, right? And one of the big challenges for him at the time was they didn't have legal representation or counsel. They didn't know who to go to for guidance even, right? Any recommendations on some of those external relationships? If you don't have your own general counsel, or if you're in an incident, like, how do you identify who can help you? Because who knows which forensics company, which law firms specialize in cybersecurity incidents that you might want to have a relationship before the incident actually happens?
Yeah, and having that relationship beforehand is tremendously helpful because of the time I mentioned that it saves. You know, if you're a small business, and I'm watching a small business right now that's affecting one of my current clients, and they're probably going to go under because they don't have a general counsel and they haven't done any of this stuff because they just didn't have the time or the money. You know, what I found working with small businesses throughout my career is that they tend to go to their accountants, and the believe it or not, accountants tend to be a clearinghouse of great information for small business owners. That's where they look for tech. It's where they look for legal help. They look for a number of things there. If I'm in a large organization with a general counsel, talking with other general counsels, or if I'm a CEO and asking for those types of things from my general counsel, or talking to other CEOs I know and networking, hey, who have you had a good experience with? What were some of the pitfalls? What were some of the other things? You know, honestly, I get numerous calls. I'll recommend a couple law firms. Actually, I always recommend two. I always get asked for three. I can recommend forensics firms, and we do a lot of that. And the folks that are in the space, whether it's the law firms, the forensics firms, or the communications firms, all kind of know each other. And there's you know who's good and who's not. And it's very apparent just based on the way they talk and the language they use and talking about the situations that they've dealt with. So if I'm a CEO in a small business or owner of a small business, I'm probably going to reach out to my accountant first. And if I'm in a larger business, I'm going to ask my general counsel, hey, who have other general counsels talked to? Or does my PR firm have any recommendations on those types of things? You'd be surprised how many actually do.
Luckily, I did for him, and he got through the incident pretty much without too many issues. They did recover the wire transfer and the money because they acted very quickly, because wire transfers have a certain day to settlement. So it actually worked out very, very well for him at the end of the day. But I would not want to be a small business that doesn't happen to have a relationship with somebody that could point them there quickly to actually resolve the incident before a time window expired, for example.
Yeah, most definitely. And but you also see with these larger organizations, I mean, I'm just going to be really candid. There isn't an excuse for them not having this stuff done ahead of time. Yes, it takes time. Yes, it takes effort. But getting it done and the savings and the help that it provides you is, to me, I just don't understand it. I wear a seatbelt. I have insurance. So, I'm also an Eagle Scout. So maybe I'm just weird that way. But for me, if I'm a CEO looking at the cost savings that potentially and how comfortable my team is having to deal with that situation, I want to get that done because it puts them in the best position to succeed. And that's ultimately what a leader is supposed to do in an organization is put their team in the best position to succeed.
Yeah, I honestly feel like the pressure on security leaders, coming from the top, where we're being looked at as that just, you know, insurance of an organization in tactical, I think we need to do a better job of educating upstream. That's the key, because when you do have the support of the CEO, when you do have the support of the board of directors, and you're having those intelligent risk-based conversations with them, it opens their eyes to see investment needs to be made and time needs to be given to these teams to perform these tasks. Because remember, when you're bringing an incident response team together, you need to make sure that you have buy-in from HR, from finance, mm-hmm. from all these other business units that you don't directly have influence over, right? So ultimately, you need the leadership, the highest levels of leadership of your company to support that financial and or time investment you need to put in. So educating upstream is extremely important.
Yeah, and I think educating downstream too and horizontally is important, right? Because having been in so many of these situations, you can't just put it all on the CISO. Right. The difficulty becomes, you know, most general counsels are not cybersecurity experts. That's mm-hmm. fine. They're paid to be, good at a number of different areas, and they all have their specialties, but most of them aren't cybersecurity. Corporate communications people aren't necessarily cybersecurity or in some cases even crisis experts, but they may be communications experts. So there's a shared responsibility across the board for communications, legal, HR, CISOs, CEOs, that everybody needs to play their role. And, and in many cases, the reason I get brought in is, and my team get brought in is because they're looking for someone they can just outsource it to that they know has done hundreds of incidents and reps, and that they know that their communications team hasn't. So it's better in many cases for them to bring in somebody like me and my team, because it allows their communications team or other functions to kind of continue business as usual while this gets handled over the side. It doesn't mean they don't ultimately get brought in, but I've seen that become a model in the last year that's been pretty interesting to watch, because there isn't much of that cybersecurity knowledge in the communications world.
Yeah. And look, communications changed in the era of COVID too. So, you know, if you haven't done a mock scenario in a remote environment, it's probably a good idea to test it, because think about all the communications when you were together, they're different now. I mean, so any organization that hasn't done a mock scenario under the remote situation we're in could also be a little behind or a little out of practice, just because the communication mechanisms have changed for us.
Yeah, they definitely have. And the other thing is, quite honestly, to your point, Matt, one of the things that's really interesting is, and you guys will understand this, you never go through one of those simulations perfectly. You always find something that's wrong, something that you could have done better, something that you mm-hmm. wish you had that you didn't, somebody that didn't perform well, et cetera. The difficulty of doing this over Zoom and Teams and IM and text and phone, the difficulty that you're going to end up hearing a lot about there is, oh my gosh, how much of that is discoverable? Because your outside counsel and your general counsel are going to be a little concerned about how much communication is suddenly, you know, in written form, even more so than it may have been before.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. In turn, becoming a business record, right? Absolutely.
Yep. And hey, any prosecutor is going to want that info.
E-discovery all day long.
Exactly.
Oh, so I took two tips away and one caution. Prepare and practice and watch what you write down.
Yes. The more that you can keep to voice, the better.
Awesome. Great.
And be nice to your CISO. They've got a really tough job.
They do, actually.
Amen. Amen.
David, thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, David.
We're going to take a quick break and then cover the leadership and communications articles for this week.
Stopping advanced threats requires knowing exactly what you're up against. ExtraHop RevealX is the only solution that shows you not just where intruders are going, but where they've been. 90-day lookback and complete network visibility across the data center, cloud, and device edge help security teams respond 84% faster with ExtraHop RevealX network detection and response. Explore the interactive demo at securityweekly.com/ExtraHop.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Paul Asadorian and Jason Albuquerque. If you missed Security Weekly Unlocked, you can now access all of the content on demand, whether you registered before the live event or not, by visiting securityweekly.com/unlocked and clicking either the button to register or the button to log in. We're going to leave that up until the end of March, and then we're going to, I think, move it to our YouTube channel, but we'll figure out a place to put it afterwards. Our next live webcast will be on March 18th at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, where you will learn how to prepare Linux hosts for unexpected threats. Visit securityweekly.com/webcast to register now. If you've missed any of our previously recorded webcasts or technical trainings, they are available for your viewing pleasure at securityweekly.com/on-demand. The articles are going to relate to our previous segment around security incidents. I pulled out a number of articles, Jason, that kind of relate mm-hmm. to the conversation we just had with David. I'm going to start with the cyber insurance one because we went down the cyber insurance rat hole a little bit. And then I did that on purpose because I wanted to bring up aspects of the cyber insurance policies. New York came out on February 4th and issued a new framework, a risk framework for cyber insurers, because the cyber insurers are paying out a little more than I think certain places would like them to pay out, and it's starting to impact the insurance industry.
Yeah, who would have thought? I mean, obviously, over the last year, I think I've engaged personally as a technology services organization with cyber liability insurance organizations more than I ever have in the past. So that tells me, and in the majority of those times were ransomware attacks, right? So, that means more organizations are, kicking in their cyber liability insurance, getting those fiduciaries assigned, and then going through the incident response process, which in turn means, payout from the insurance organization. So, it's definitely something that I've seen coming down the pipeline. I've been having conversations with insurance brokers and insurance agencies where, they're basically saying, listen, how can we be better at assessing risk of our customers so we know what type of liability we're taking on?
Yeah.
So those insurance brokers and agencies are actually looking at it and saying, hey, we can be doing things better.
And I like it as helping you with some of the costs that you would incur during a breach.
Yeah.
Not all of them, right? I think we have to be careful.
Sure.
Which costs that we, are assigning to the insurance company. I don't think, for example, they should be allowed by law, and this may be controversial, but I don't think they should be allowed to cover your payment to the ransom, because I think that's funding enemy nation states and funding terrorists and other cyber criminals.
That actually gets brought up in this article, right, about how they're saying you should not pay ransom, right? They're recommending that you don't. And I mean, you guys know me, right? Come from the military. You don't negotiate with terrorists. I have that same type of philosophy. You don't negotiate with terrorists. The problem that we're finding is that you're going to get into situations, and I've heard it directly from CFOs, where they say, we're going to use any tool available to us to get our business up and running as quickly as we possibly can. And if paying the ransom is the least amount of money we're going to have to pay to get our business up and running, we'll do it. So there needs to be some level of legal angle there to say, no, you're not going to hit the easy button. No, you're not going to pay the ransom. And no, you're not going to perpetuate these ransomware attacks.
Yeah, I mean, we covered the article when Treasury came out and basically said, look, don't pay these ransoms. Mm-hmm. New York Department of Financial Services basically came out, reiterated, do not pay the ransom, and then laid out a framework to say, look, you insurers need to manage your risk of your policies, the companies you're insuring, and these different policies, whether known or unknown, because you potentially could put yourself into a liquidity issue if you continue to pay out some of these cyber insurance claims. So it was interesting, like the first 4 out of 7 is all around risk management, which is what an insurer should be doing anyways, because they are the ultimate risk managers, right? But there was a couple other ones that got interesting towards the end, right? Educate insured and insurance producers, right? So that puts a burden on the brokers and stuff to do some education. Get cybersecurity expertise. Well, what does that mean?
Hey, wow, who would have thought?
Wow, who would have thunk it?
You know, between us three here, you know, and probably every single one of our listeners, that's table stakes. But hey, we got to line it up and actually show people this is what you have to do, right?
The last one was required notice to law enforcement,
right?
Which could be FBI, it could be local authorities, but it's going to force a notification to law enforcement, which triggers some very interesting things depending on who the organization is.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Once you open the door to law enforcement, game on, right?
Yep, exactly. But,
I mean, a lot of companies don't want to do that because they're like, wait, what else are they going to find?
Now you're open to e-discovery. Yeah. We talked about it in the last segment, right? Mm-hmm. So it's one of those laws of unintended consequences. You've just opened up the door to e-discovery, and now, you know, you could be liable for some things.
Right, exactly right. And yeah, you don't know how far that scope goes once you open that door, right?
Absolutely.
And if you're in a highly regulated area, think about that. There is no more hiding this kind of stuff under the covers to try to stay away from the regulators.
No. But at the end of the day, I agree with where we're going as far as, you know, New York state law and what they're doing. Number one, again, to help mitigate paying out those ransoms, because that's not something that I believe is a good strategy. Sounds like Paul agrees with me, right? But also to really make the insurance companies step up and do something about making sure that their client base has a good, strong security posture and maturity. And if not, give them the ability to help mature those organizations, right? Because again, it shouldn't be a situation where the insurance agencies say, no, we're not going to insure you. It's more of a, here are the things we need you to start doing, and we need some type of a remediation schedule to get you on board to where you need to be, right? So they should be leaving their clients better than they found them and giving them a path.
Yeah, I know AIG has some programs for their insurers. I know Zurich and Marsh & McLellan are pretty mature in their programs.
Yes.
So, I mean, look, I think some of the insurers are doing the right things. I think there's a whole lot of other insurers that may not be at that same level.
Agreed.
But to your point, giving organizations the ability to get the resources and help they need to better mature themselves as part of these policies, I think would be a great thing.
Yeah. And again, having on the roles of a cyber liability insurance incident response program, having a ransomware negotiator on those roles should not, that lever is something we should never be pulling.
Yeah. Interesting. I switched it up a little bit. We're going to go back to security incidents and business continuity because some of the later articles, but I pulled this article on financial targets and motivation for employees. And I thought this was interesting because when you think about how we build comp plans, MBOs, we think a lot about the financial impact, and financial results are an outcome, not a root driver for employee performance. And I thought it was very interesting because, you know, in our business, we're pretty open about our financials and kind of tracking. And some of the comp plans obviously have financial metrics to them, but what they're saying is, look, this cannot be part of every employee's because it just basically, it's not a motivator. It actually turns your employees off.
Yeah, 100%. Again, it's know your audience, right? As a leader, you're trying to motivate your teams, right, to meet certain outcomes. So all of those incentive programs that you build should be building toward the outcome you're looking to achieve. And always talking about finances is not the outcome, right? That's a company outcome. That's a conversation I'm having with my CEO. That's a conversation that I'm having with my peers, with the board of directors. And in some instances, right, very targeted and meaningful with the team, but that's not the everyday conversation. It can't be the everyday conversation because ultimately your team's going to think that all you're motivated about is the mighty dollar.
Yeah,
you want to be the why.
You want a growth plan. You don't want short-term goals to be rewarded with just monetary compensation.
Exactly.
'Cause it has to be a career in growth planning, right? That employees are going to meet goals and be happy and be rewarded and feel like they have a purpose is more important. And that, you know, there's a career path more so than, you know, short-term goals for monetary compensation. I've experienced
100%.
Don't work.
100% agreed.
Next article, after the breach and beyond, really close tie to the last segment. I brought this in because I think he brings up some very interesting points here on aspects of the response after the breach and beyond. We talked a lot about preparedness in the last segment. And so this kind of just another source, I think, for people to really take a look at to say, how do I prepare for the breach and what are the things I have to do pre, during, and post breach? And so this was an interesting.
Yeah, article. No, I mean, I thought the article, the beginning of the article was great, right? And as I started going through deeper down into the article, I think it kind of took a left turn eventually, right? Once it started talking about like NIST 861 and incident handling guide, like I get that. That's something, you know, we live NIST every day where I work. And at the end of the day, you know, the things that were outlined, like efforts following in the areas of reputation repair and restoration and risk management program and awareness and training. You know, if you look at NIST 861, those aren't even the top items that come into play, you know, with that framework. You know, they're really talking about from the beginning, how do you build an effective program, right? And what all of those components, kind of like what we talked about in the last segment, here are all the things you need to do to build a mature incident response program. So it kind of took a left turn toward the middle-ish end, but that beginning of the article was pretty good.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good too. Texas power outage flags need to revisit business continuity. This is for Slack himself. Look, we know what Texas went through.
Yeah.
But it also impacted a whole bunch of people outside the state of Texas.
Absolutely.
And because they had their data centers in Texas. State Farm had a huge outage. California Medical, because their IBM data center was in Texas.
Yeah.
And have we forgotten about business continuity and disaster recovery?
I don't. So this is a very touchy subject for me, right? Because at the end of the day, so we have a data center in Dallas as well, right? And we didn't skip a beat. At the end of the day, because we prepared for it. We literally spun up an incident command team based on IT, security, operational folks, and our client services side of the aisle to continuously monitor whether or not there was a blip in our data center in Dallas, right? To make sure that our high availability was going to kick into play and we were going to be resilient. But that's a resilience team. That's a resilience team that's made up of security, IT, these operational teams, right? So we have this business resilience planning. And I'm going to be 100% honest with you, right? If I as a leader did not grab that bull by the horns and say, I'm managing our business continuity for the organization holistically, it would have been, you know, it would have been a siloed activity. So ultimately, you need to have someone driving the success of BCDR within your organization to make sure it's successful. And I think in part, it's a shared responsibility. Security leaders need to have a play in there. IT leaders need to have play in there. And then your business units need to have play in there as well, right? So yeah, I mean, it definitely caught folks who were not prepared off guard.
Because it's hard to deal with that low probability, high impact event. And that's what Texas, you know, one of the things it showed us is that it's never like 0% risk. You could always have, you know, again, it's that low probability that you're like, the chances of that happening and high impact, we as humans don't like to believe that something that bad is going to happen. Therefore, Jason, to your point, we may not put any resources behind it unless someone like Jason or other champions in your organization go, yeah, I understand it's low probability and high impact, but we still need a plan because if it does happen, our answer can't be, oh, we're just totally screwed, which was unfortunately, a lot of people's homes and infrastructure in Texas.
Yeah, yeah. And ultimately, I took the mentality of if the stuff were to hit the fan, I'm going to have to be engaged anyway.
Yep.
And let me tell you, I want to make it as painless as possible.
Right.
So if nobody's owning this, I'm going to freaking own it. And I'm going to make sure it's getting done correctly. Because, again, we talk about it on the show all the time. Leadership isn't necessarily a title. Just take a leadership role and get it done. If nobody's doing it and you know it's a gap, be that person who can be the catalyst for getting it done.
Yeah, and security has to be at the table because your backup can't be, oh, our SSH communications went down, so we're just going to fall back to Telnet. It'll be totally fine, right?
Like, exactly.
Security still has to exist.
You got it.
Yeah.
So there's going to be an adverse effect on the security team no matter what. So if nobody's owning it and it's not up to date and it's not modernized and it's not being tested, take the bull by the horns. It will show that you're taking a leadership role in the organization and elevate your position in the organization. I can guarantee it.
Yeah, and I think the challenge for most CISOs, this is one of many things that potentially falls on their plate.
Yeah.
And it may not be the highest priority at the moment because you're dealing with, a breach or you're dealing with, shift to remote work and all this other stuff. And it's like you almost kind of forget about it in the back of your mind.
Right.
I mean,
right.
one of my first projects, and I think I've told this story before, when I left the nuclear world, I went to oil and gas. And my first task when I went down there was build the business continuity disaster recovery plan in case a hurricane came up the Gulf and hit New Orleans, which is where their big refinery was.
Yep.
That was my first task. And I remember, all the planning that went into thinking about that. To Paul's point, low probability, high impact. But Katrina hit like 7-8 years later, and they had to execute that plan. But if you didn't prepare for it, there was no way you were going to be able to recover from that event quickly.
Absolutely. And think about the benefit of just that preparation, right? That preparation over time that was done, the huge benefit it had at the end of the day. And again, I say this, that it's a shared responsibility across the organization, but somebody needs to quarterback the initiative if it's not being done by anyone. So why not security folks, risk folks, right? At least quarterback the conversation. And then from there, maybe someone else gets designated, an operational leader or an IT leader or whatever the case may be. But at least know go into it knowing you're doing your due diligence to raise a risk, because it's part of a risk profile of an organization, right? Your job as a CISO is to identify some risk. Well, guess what? If your BCDR plan sucks, that's a risk.
Yep. And if your security incident program sucks, that's a risk. And if your security training and awareness program sucks, that's a risk. So this next article talks about undervalued, ineffective, why security programs still fall short. But yet I read this thing, it's all the things we know, and you get down to solutions for success. And it's like, really, that's it? I mean, we turn it into short burst video games and problem solved.
Yeah.
I didn't see the solution fully come out in this article.
Yeah, nah, boo. That's all I can say. Yeah, I mean, honestly, I don't know. It definitely wasn't something that I got a lot of value out of. I'll put it that way. Because
a lot of problem discussion, which we all know.
Sure.
But then I get down to the solution for success area, and it's
gamification.
It's like, oh yeah, make a game out of it, make it fun for employees, and that'll fix everyone's problem.
Yeah, no,
it's
like, not at all.
The goal is to raise awareness. Yep. How do you keep basically raising awareness?
That's it, right?
That will have an impact in a positive manner if there is a heightened state of awareness and you maintain that heightened state of awareness. That essentially what it comes down to, making employees realize that in all communications, someone could be lying to you.
Yes.
And constantly keeping that awareness up is the goal. And
I couldn't agree more,
help.
Right? And some of the places where I see the most impact, because you want to know what? Doing trainings in an LMS and taking a quiz later failed. It's failed over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. Doesn't work, right? Checks in the box, failure. What I've seen works the best is honestly taking very, very quick communications, whether it's video, email communications, messages through like Teams or Slack or whatever the case may be, and making it very meaningful to the end user, meaning personal life. I found the best success when I've equated things to folks' personal lives that they can transition into the business and they remember them. They remember them. I've received emails from folks on our finance team, clerks on the finance team saying, hey, I took this communication. I brought it back to my parents because they were being scammed. Right. And I used your email to show them
where
the scam was happening and to teach them about these types of scams that are happening. That's a win. That's a win for me because they're taking it in their personal lives. They're using it, which will easily transition into the business world.
Yeah, agreed. Oh, anyways. Oh, last article. Oh, one more. We're doing, we're going through, you know, we know that there's a skills gap shortage. We're out interviewing people. I thought this was a really good article. Like, how do you do background checks? Paul was talking about a little bit before, right? Like, people are going to lie to you somewhere along the way, right? And so we think about, okay, well, how do I validate the trustworthiness of the candidates I'm looking at? What can you and can't you do when it comes to background checks? And so I thought this was a good article because it lays out some of the things you can't do, right? You can't ask about lifestyle, age, marital status, disabilities, religion, blah, blah, blah. Those are all off the table. But it does give
unless
you
the federal government point of clarification. Different story.
Right.
That's true. You can't do it, but Uncle Sam can do it. And maybe be able to put it on a census or not a census. I'm not quite sure where the current state of that is.
I've heard this from folks that have worked for, you know, three-letter government agencies that they, at least in the past, I'm not sure how it works today, do ask about your political affiliations and things of that nature.
Interesting.
But as an employer, non-government employer, basically you're verifying that what the person has told you in the application process is true. Like, did you actually work there? Did you actually get that degree? Right? That's really the goal of the background check, right?
Yeah.
Is to make sure the person's not lying to you.
That's it, right? And to be honest with you, this is an instance when I sit down and I partner with my HR team heavily. Right. Because from a human resources perspective, I want to know what I can do, what I can't do, what I can ask, what I can't ask to make sure that we're above bar. Right. At the end of the day. And, you know, we have certain processes that we follow depending. Right. So for U.S. domestic folks, we have certain background checks we can do. For international folks, we have a little bit different process, a little bit different. But now you're dealing with, you know, international type court records that you can pull, right? So similar but a little bit different depending on domestic versus overseas.
Yeah, and I thought the guidelines here, look, you can do reference checks at I think pretty much anywhere, and you should do reference checks, right? Check references. Good check. I mean, identity confirmation, you're going to have to do an I-4 at least in the U.S. And so you're going to have to do some level of identity confirmation as part of employment, right?
Yep.
It's the court records and some of the other database checks that I'm like, I don't know where you can and can't do those.
Could vary by state,
It could vary, yeah.
True.
That gets tricky if the business and the employee are in different states. So I say check with your attorneys and state regulations to make sure you are in compliance. And if you're hiring hackers, I mean, the fact that they have a court record, that could be a thing.
It bothers
some people, which I think is a shame, but it should.
Yeah. I'm going to be 100% candid here and say that I glean more information out of an interview than I do out of any of these background checks, unless something's a huge red flag, obviously, right? I mean, that's bar none obvious, but you know, I'll glean more out of an interview because we're looking for attitude and aptitude and you know, depending on the questions you ask, you can pull out things like integrity and whether or not they're lying about their education record or anything like that. So, you know, I think that live conversation is a very key piece to this as well.
Yeah, agree. But I mean, there's some organizations are going to want to do certain checks. And so, you know, good checklist if you need to, do some background checks on your candidates. You might do them for your employees. I don't know. I think Paul and I think you and I did go through one actually.
Yeah, so. I will. In acquisitions, yes, you will have to do that stuff. I think that's pretty standard.
Yeah. Gentlemen, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining me today. Thank you everyone for watching and listening. And we'll see you next week on Business Security Weekly.